Welcome back to the Stanford Psychology Podcast, where leading scientists share their recent work. This week, I have the pleasure of chatting with George Mashour, the Robert B. Sweet Professor and Chair of the Department of Anesthesiology at the University of Michigan. Professor Mashour was the founding director of the University of Michigan Center for Consciousness Science and the Michigan Psychedelic Center. In this episode, we discuss the reinvigorated study of psychedelics and the light it may shed on different dimensions of consciousness. Professor Mashour weighs in on the ongoing normative debate about how psychedelic drugs should be defined. Should they be defined on a molecular level by their mechanism of action in the brain, or based upon the subjective experience they produce in the user? He relates the results of an exciting recent study that uses psychedelic drugs as a tool to alter normal states of consciousness. This enables him to compare brain network dynamics in these altered states of consciousness with those dynamics in normal states of consciousness and with those in lowered states of consciousness induced by anesthesia. In some ways, this technique allows us to peer into the brain to find out what brain activity is associated with particular experiences. Professor Mashour also offers his perspective on two of the most prominent theories of consciousness and a groundbreaking ongoing adversarial collaboration evaluating them. Okay. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. I'm here today with Professor George Mashour, really looking forward to our discussion on states of consciousness and psychedelics. We're planning to start our conversation by focusing on your recent paper, Classical and Non-Classical Psychedelic Drugs Induce Common Network Changes in Human Cortex. To begin our discussion, maybe we can begin by unpacking the title a little bit. How would you define psychedelic drugs?
Well, that's a great question, and I think it's an ongoing question. And there are many who would define a psychedelic drug as a psychoactive drug that works primarily at the 5-HT2, 5-hydroxytryptamine, the serotonin receptor. And these would be, at the very least, considered the classical psychedelics, such as LSD or psilocybin, DMT. But I would argue that we should have a more expanded perspective, that we shouldn't define the drug class exclusively based on the molecular target, but rather with a multidimensional, multi-scale framework. And I think that ketamine and nitrous oxide, but certainly ketamine, presents an interesting challenge to this very restrictive, molecularly focused definition of psychedelics.
That sounds fascinating. Why ketamine and nitrous oxide in particular?
Well, first of all, I have to say that we have a particular history here at the University of Michigan with ketamine because it was first studied in humans, and the first clinical studies of ketamine took place in the Department of Anesthesiology, which is my department, as well as the Department of Pharmacology here at the University of Michigan in the mid-1960s. Ketamine was designed as an evolution of phencyclidine, or PCP, angel dust, which was a very effective anesthetic, but it would induce florid emergence delirium and reactions. And so the goal was to develop something that had the anesthetic properties, but didn't have this deliriogenic effect during emergence. And so one compound emerged that ultimately was called ketamine, and it was first tested in humans in Michigan. It was synthesized at Park Davis in Michigan, and then ultimately tested clinically here at the University of Michigan. And I worked with Professor Ed Domino, who is the clinical pharmacologist. He passed away recently in his late 90s, but just a fascinating, inspiring scientist. And it's something that I've studied just because it's such a unique compound because it can be an anesthetic, a psychedelic, an antidepressant, an analgesic, depending on the different doses. So ketamine doesn't appear to work primarily at this 5-HT2 receptor. It's thought to be an NMDA antagonist. It's thought to work through HCN1 channels. These are like pacemaker channels in the brain. So it doesn't fit that strict definition. But if we look at different scales, we see that there are a lot of similarities with these classical psychedelics. So for example, classical psychedelics increase neurophysiologic complexity as measured through EEG, for example. Ketamine does the same thing. Psilocybin as a classical psychedelic can induce plasticity and changes in the neuron, like arborization of dendrites. Ketamine can do the same thing. Psilocybin has antidepressant properties after a single administration. Ketamine does as well. So there are a number of similarities, and this is something that we wanted to explore in a broader sense, study nitrous oxide, or laughing gas, as people know it. It's really the only gas that's been in continuous clinical use as an anesthetic since the mid-1800s, when the field of anesthesiology was born. But at sub-anesthetic concentrations, it has psychoactive and psychedelic effects. And nobody had really explored those systematically. So we conducted a neuroimaging study of healthy volunteers. There were 22 of them. There are a couple of different dimensions of the study, but I'll focus on the one of relevance to this discussion, which is there was a baseline scan. There was also EEG. There was administration of nitrous oxide, sub-anesthetic concentrations. There was neuroimaging. And then they emerged, and then there was another recovery scan. And afterwards, we assessed the subjective experiences through a validated altered states questionnaire. And first of all, in terms of those reports, we found that nitrous oxide, like classical psychedelics, seemed to fit a definition of a psychedelic experience. Now, there are some qualitative differences with nitrous and ketamine compared to the classical psychedelics. And that is, one salient feature is referred to as dissociation, or a sense of disembodiment. So there are some phenomenological distinctions between ketamine and nitrous, sometimes referred to as dissociatives because of that quality of disembodiment, and the classical psychedelics. So we wanted to expand this and compare nitrous oxide to ketamine, which has some similar properties, but then also a classical psychedelic. And in this case, it was LSD. We accessed a publicly available data set, thanks to Dr. Robin Carhart-Harris, who's a real pioneer in the renaissance of psychedelic neuroscience. And we were looking for what was different, but also what was common across these distinct drugs. And they are quite distinct. Nitrous oxide is inhaled. Ketamine is intravenous. There are different molecular targets. There's some different phenomenological characteristics. So we were expecting differences. But we also found some similarities and some common effects at the broad scale, at the large scale brain network level. And that was, all three drugs tended to weaken local networks, weaken or diminish those local connections or conversations, if you will, but enhance conversations across different functional brain networks. And they all had that similar property. Now, the networks that were talking to each other were distinct, but that general effect on the large-scale brain networks was common. So then we wanted to focus in and see if there were any overlapping connectivity patterns across these three drugs. And what we found is that there were a number of shared connectivity patterns. But we said, wait a second, maybe some of these connectivity patterns just happen when you are in any kind of transition in a state of consciousness. So we then brought in another drug, propofol, which is an anesthetic. Now, drugs like propofol have a mirror image effect on the brain. So psychedelics enhance neurophysiologic complexity. Anesthetics suppress neurophysiologic complexity. Psychedelics expand the repertoire of brain states or connectivity states. Anesthetics diminish it. Anesthetics strengthen local conversations and diminish long-range communications. So we wanted to include this as a control. And by doing so, we were able to take out one pattern that was common to all four drugs. So we said, this pattern shouldn't be linked to the psychedelic state because it's also happening in the anesthetic state.
What was that pattern, if I ask?
It related to the anterior insula, which is a really interesting structure that has been hypothesized to serve a number of different roles, including, as some would claim, a seat of the self or a source of interoceptive integration. It's also important for anesthetic state transitions. It's important in pain. We published on it to show that's important in regulating brain state transitions and also creating access to conscious contents or sensory contents. So a really interesting structure, but didn't seem to be specific to the psychedelics. And what we found was that there were certain patterns related to an area of the brain called the temporoparietal junction, which seemed to have some overlapping connections with areas in the posterior part of the cortex. And that's interesting for a couple of reasons. First of all, the temporoparietal junction, especially the right TPJ as it's referred to, seems to be important for multisensory integration. So taking various sensory modalities and combining or synthesizing them so we can have the textured, multidimensional, but still seamless experience that we have right now. So that's one function. Another function is it's thought to be important for a sense of body ownership. What does that mean? This has come up in a number of different experimental paradigms, like what's called the rubber hand illusion, where you're kind of tricking the brain into thinking that something that's not part of your body is. But in very concrete terms, individuals who have had pathologic lesions, stroke, for example, in the TPJ have spontaneous out-of-body experiences. It's provocative to think about it in the context of something like ketamine or nitrous oxide, right, where you have that disembodiment. But it was also true for LSD. So that the TPJ was one interesting aspect. The other interesting aspect is that the shared connectivity patterns seem to be in this area of the brain that's informally referred to as the posterior cortical hot zone of consciousness. There are big debates going on right now in the science of consciousness in terms of the role of prefrontal cortex, the front of the brain, the anterior cortex, and or the posterior cortex. And so one body of thought and one prominent scientific theory suggests that it's that posterior complex that really defines the content or the qualitative aspects of our conscious experience. So the fact that these psychedelics, which don't have major effects on arousal states, they might depending on the dose, but do have a big impact on the content or qualities of our consciousness, all seem to be functioning in a certain way in structures that have been hypothesized to be critical for it. Again, there are lots of differences, and I don't want to glide over those or disregard those, but I think it is interesting to say there are some shared phenomenological features across these diverse drugs, and there are some shared network configurations. Now the question is, does that correlation mean causation? And we're not able to test that. So at any rate, that ties back into your question of how do we define the class of psychedelic drugs by suggesting that despite some differences in molecular targets, there still can be some shared effects at the level of large-scale brain networks, where one might argue consciousness or conscious experience emerges from that higher level rather than the molecular level.
So speaking of these major debates that have been happening in the field of consciousness research recently between some of these studies that might suggest that prefrontal cortex and frontal areas are very important in consciousness versus some studies, perhaps like this one, that highlight the contributions of this posterior cortical hot zone. Do you think that your research supports the view that the posterior cortical hot zone is really contributing to contents of consciousness? How do you think using psychedelics provides you a lens onto that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't know the answer. It might. There might also be effects in the prefrontal cortex that we're just not measuring correctly, or that we might need another modality to measure. I tend to think that the prefrontal cortex is important for consciousness, and that can be debated. It is being debated. And there's a reason to think that the prefrontal cortex might be important for psychedelics as well. And that is because there's a really high concentration, certainly the classical psychedelics, a really high concentration of these 5-HT2 receptors in the medial prefrontal cortex. It is a target. It's a candidate as a biological substrate for some of the effects of psychedelics. I think we also have to think about the different kinds of consciousness that have been defined. And I could spend an hour talking to you about the nomenclature of consciousness. In fact, I do when I give a lecture for a neuroscience graduate program course on consciousness, and I spend an hour just on the nomenclature. But one distinction that was drawn by the philosopher Ned Block is the difference between phenomenal consciousness and access consciousness. Phenomenal consciousness is like the pure experiential aspect of consciousness. Access consciousness is like what we do with that and connecting it to other cognitive functions like working memory and attention and the ability to generate a plan for action. And so it's thought that the prefrontal cortex likely has more of a role in conscious access, in that access consciousness dimension, and that the posterior area might contribute more to the phenomenology. So they're not necessarily, even the theories themselves are not necessarily mutually exclusive. And some would argue that we need to do a better job of integrating them or having a more pluralistic account. So that would be my response to that. But really, it's a hot topic right now. And there's an interesting scientific experiment going on, not just a lab experiment, an experiment in science, which is a funded program from the Templeton Foundation, which is being referred to as an adversarial collaboration. And so this adversarial collaboration involves many of the prominent theorists that are advocating or have developed these different frameworks for consciousness, then independent scientists across the world who are defining experiments that would get at key questions to differentiate the theories, agreeing to the terms. So there's no wiggling out when something else comes up in terms of a result that might contradict the original theories. So there's a pre-specified agreement as to what the interpretive framework will be. And these data are just starting to come out. So I think this is a really dynamic time in the science of consciousness. I think psychedelics play a role in helping us understand some of the neurobiological substrates, just as anesthetics do in a different kind of way.
So what you're saying is that psychedelics can help us study changes in the phenomenology, whereas anesthetics might be able to help us study changes in access consciousness?
That's a good question. I'd frame it a little bit differently. And this gets to something another conceptual framework or heuristic from the 2000s describing the dimensions of consciousness. And two major dimensions would be the level of consciousness. It's like the global state of arousal, awake, somnolent, asleep, anesthetized, comatose, brain dead. So that global state of arousal, and then the content of consciousness, which would be more like the phenomenology, the awareness, the what's going on, what it's like to be in this state right now. And so I think one way of framing it would be that anesthetics and sleep are great ways to study the level of consciousness, the global state of arousal, and that psychedelics are a great way to study the content of consciousness. The global state stays the same, but the phenomenology changes. Now, with that being said, there can be a lot of debate and healthy discussion about these dimensions. Why should we only have two? There might be many more dimensions of consciousness. And some of these more richly multidimensional frameworks have, in fact, been described. And then also, they're often depicted as perpendicular to one another, orthogonal. One could take issue with that and say, is it really meaningful to say I have no level of consciousness, but I can have this incredibly rich content of consciousness? Or I could have a really high level of arousal, but have no phenomenology whatsoever. And so some people are also trying to figure out, how do these interact? Is consciousness a product of these different dimensions rather than having them be orthogonal to one another?
So in terms of this study, how do you think the findings here inform the field at large? How do they contribute to some of these bigger debates? For example, the big adversarial collaboration between different theories.
Yeah, I think this is just part of the puzzle. I think where the results are meaningful to me gets back to your original question of how do we define these drugs, and do we need to take a multi-level view?
Right.
Not just focusing on the molecular target, but what's happening at the level of brain networks, for example, which again might arguably be closer to the source of conscious experience than what's happening at an individual receptor. So that's where I personally think it's interesting. I don't know if the field does, but I do. And we have recently written, actually, my colleague, Nick Denemy, who's at Stanford right now, used to be a graduate student here at the University of Michigan and somebody worked with over the past years. You know, we just wrote up a piece and created a framework that incorporates these data and other data to make an argument that we should have a broader, more multidimensional perspective on how we define psychedelic, especially because there's a lot that's up in the air regarding the mechanism. And I'll just point out a few studies. And let me be very clear. I'm not suggesting that the 5-HT2 receptor has no relevance to the psychedelic experience. It does. And I think there are robust data to suggest that. But for example, there was a fairly recent article demonstrating that the 5-HT2 receptors that might be of interest in the mechanism don't reside on the membrane of the neuron, but rather inside of it, that they're actually intracellular, which is not what people were thinking before. And some of the plasticity effects that are thought to be important vis-a-vis the therapeutic potential might not be mediated through 5-HT2, but rather the receptor that controls the expression of brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And that might be where the action is in terms of plasticity. So I think this story is evolving even at the molecular and receptor level. And so having a framework that allows some flexibility in that regard will be important. The other thing that comes up when you think about this strictly molecular definition is the case of non-hallucinogenic psychedelic analogs. And this gets to a big question right now, which is how are these drugs, these really interesting drugs, achieving a therapeutic benefit? Is it from the experience, the so-called trip? Do we need to have that conscious experience for the therapeutic effect? Or is it just a drug action in the brain that can happen independently of a psychedelic experience? Or is it a combination of both? Or is it a combination of one of these with the psychotherapy or support systems or integrative processes that often happen in association with these studies? So this is an open, interesting question. But from my perspective, it's interesting in linking this 5-HT2 receptor with the term psychedelic, that we'd be talking about a psychedelic analog of a drug that has presumably no psychedelic phenomenology, but we're not calling ketamine a psychedelic, even though it does have shared phenomenology and a number of other different features. So that's where I think that these data might be interesting in helping us to think about how we classify psychedelics. And I'd also point out, so I'm a neuroscientist, but a clinical anesthesiologist, and I think about just a number of different drug classes that really aren't defined by the molecular target. They're defined by the physiologic effect or therapeutic effect. So antihypertensives, for example, drugs that lower your blood pressure, have a variety of different molecular mechanisms, but they're considered within a framework because of their overall physiologic effect.
And so maybe it would also make sense to use that type of definition on this drug class as well.
It's something to consider. I mean, I think there are different trends in psychiatry to have more of a neuroscientifically defined definition. But I think that entails not just what's happening at a molecular level, but at various neural scales.
Really fascinating. Thank you for taking us through the basics of the study and its implications. Taking a step back from this specific work, how did you become interested in this?
So it depends on how far you want me to go back. I've been interested, seriously interested in consciousness since I was studying philosophy as an undergraduate. And when I was a junior in college, I was studying The Critique of Pure Reason by Immanuel Kant, which was published in 1781. And I was just so engaged by this text. And I said to myself, I think I want to study this or be involved somehow with consciousness for my career. Now, at the time, I was really a scientific moron, I think would be a good word. I was a horrible science student in high school, and I went into college just really interested in hardcore liberal arts. High school, I was interested in fine arts. And then in college, because I was in a great books program that it was all core curriculum, and I also had to read the great books of math and science, I started really connecting with it. And I said, well, you know what? I'm getting more and more interested in science. I have this interest in consciousness. Maybe I will pivot and try to take a scientific approach to this. Clinically, I chose originally to go into psychiatry. I was also really interested in psychoanalysis because I thought psychiatry would be a great way to combine interests in neuroscience, medicine, and philosophy. But then I ultimately transitioned into anesthesiology for a number of different reasons, but in part because I had this incredible tool set to study consciousness. And it's remarkable. So the first public demonstration of surgery under general anesthesia was in 1846, October 16th, 1846. And since then, there's not been a single case report of a single individual who could not be anesthetized.
That's incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. These drugs work 100% of the time. Now, operating rooms used to explode because these volatile anesthetics, but people died on induction. But the drug, in terms of achieving its therapeutic effect of inducing unconsciousness to facilitate surgery, they work 100% of the time. And they also work across all of biology. So it's not just humans. Clearly, you can study them in mammalian species, but they also work in Drosophila, the fruit fly. And they work in C. elegans, the nematode. Plants can be anesthetized. You can inhibit reversibly photosynthesis or phototaxis. The venous flytrap will stop trapping under anesthesia in a reversible way. But it gets even better. You can anesthetize a single cell organism. So not only does it not have a brain, it doesn't even have a neuron. I mean, it's just a cell. And so these drugs work across all of biology. And so from my perspective, like, what an incredible tool to probe sentience or sensation or receptivity or interaction with the environment just across all of biology. So bizarrely, the Critique of Pure Reason by Immanuel Kant got me into being an anesthesiologist. And I was studying consciousness as a junior faculty. I founded a Center for Consciousness Science here at the University of Michigan in 2014. And we focused primarily, as I described before, on anesthetics and sleep as tools to modulate level of consciousness. But ketamine and nitrous oxide helped me make this transition because they serve a double duty depending on the dose. They can be used and are used clinically in anesthetic regimens, but at sub-anesthetic levels have psychedelic properties. And so we were studying this. I had an NIH grant to study this. But then the graduate students that we were recruiting, they had their finger on the pulse of what was happening on the psychedelic neuroscience scene before it started to explode. And they pushed us in a really positive way. And that led us to make a commitment to shift gears in the lab, where we still study anesthetics, but we're also psilocybin and DMT and salvinorin and DOI. So that's been the evolution. Really interested in consciousness from the philosophical perspective, that evolving to neuroscience and anesthesiology, that shift to thinking about ketamine and nitrous oxide and those multiple dimensions, and then moving on to the more classical psychedelics.
One interesting trajectory. If you were to go back to when you were in college, do you think that you would give yourself the advice to make the same decisions?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it just taps into this bigger question of our paths, our existential paths, our intellectual paths, our personal paths. And also what might look like disorder in the moment of decision making, but that is just part of an emergent plan for life. I think it also taps into how we interpret failures in our life. So I was an abysmal science student in high school, and I really felt like a failure as a result. But looking back now, would I change that? No, I wouldn't, because that revealed a certain path. It got me to a certain college that focused on a radical liberal arts education that, contrary to my expectation, got me engaged in science in a way that I never would have been engaged in if I had gone to a more conventional university with a conventional curriculum. And yeah, it felt uncomfortable making some of those transitions or dropping out of my psychiatry residency. I'd been planning on it for years, and making a jump to anesthesiology, which I had never even done in medical school. I started a residency without ever having rotated on it. It was just a total leap of faith. So, you know, looking back, I wouldn't really change anything. And I would just encourage, you know, any students who are listening, people who are on part of that journey, and I'm on a journey myself, that it's okay sometimes to evolve and that things can emerge in a different way. Now, I'm not suggesting that we all be capricious or undisciplined, But looking back, I'm really grateful that I had those experiences. I'm grateful that I had a liberal arts education. I'm grateful that I did some academic fellowships in psychoanalysis, which has made me explore different connections with anesthesia that I would have never explored before. So anyway, I think it's been an interesting journey. It's an ongoing journey, and I wouldn't really change a thing.
Well, that's very encouraging for all the young scientists out there. More broadly, in terms of the field, what are your hopes for the field? What would you like to see happen in the next 10 years?
What I think is really important right now is that we're rigorous and that we learn lessons of the past. This isn't the first era in which people have been really excited about using psychedelics as a tool to understand consciousness or to treat psychiatric disease. This has happened before in the 1950s and the 1960s. And also, let me disclose with humility that there are just many incredible psychedelic neuroscientists out there. I'm not counting myself among them. I just have a broader set of activities. So I don't want to speak with the pretension of too much authority here, or the presumption of too much authority. But I think it's really important that we learn the lesson of the past, because there was unbridled enthusiasm that was not tempered by rigor, by a sense of responsibility, by self-critical reflection. And I think that's really important, because there's lots of momentum right now, but that can all come crashing down if we're not on a disciplined path. And so my tagline and phrase is that we should not stigmatize psychedelic research, but neither should we romanticize it. We have to be critical. And we also have to take a broader look at clinical research. The literature of clinical research is strewn with examples of small clinical trials that had really big positive effects in the study, with no safety events, that when expanded to large scale, multi-center, highly rigorous, pragmatic trials, that therapeutic effect either became markedly attenuated or disappeared, and you start to see the safety effects. And so I think we need to really, we can be enthusiastic. I'm enthusiastic. I think these are really unique, remarkable drugs that have incredible potential. But I think we need to really be rigorous. We need to be responsible, because if we want this to be transformative and really have an impact on healthcare, we have to have a really solid body of evidence to present to people who are super interested in psychedelics, like I am or you are, that might be afraid of them, that might still think about the baggage from the past. Or it's not going to work if we're just preaching to the choir, as they say. So we need to be rigorous. We need to be credible. We need to be responsible. We need to build a really solid, unshakable foundation of scientific evidence, foundational discovery scholarship, as well as clinical research, so we can build a strong case and a strong foundation for a larger scale mainstream therapy.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It has been absolutely fascinating to speak with you.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Thank you so much to all of our listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.